Questions? So, the lineup, the thing that will play the role of the culmination quiz for the next exam is to be able to recognize constellations. So what I'll be doing, maybe Friday of next week, plopping dots on the overhead projector and asking you to identify the constellation. And so if you go online, there's a list of the constellations to know. There are kind of flashcard versions of them, so you can practice them. I guess one comment is that it's really easier on the web than it is in real life. Things are more exaggerated on the web because you just have 72 dots per inch as opposed to 600 dots per inch that you have in a transparency. So, but I think it's the best way to start is to look at those online versions. Home Lab 1 is due, the scan of it is due October 10th. I keep a record in email of who's done what, and I've transferred to the best of my knowledge the emails I've gotten into purple dots and green dots on that sheet. So you can check to see if you've got, if we agree that you turned in your Home Lab 2, there should be a green dot. If we agree that you've turned in your Home Lab 1 scan, there should be a purple dot on that sheet. Move on to the next chapter, chapter 5 on light, which we'll maybe touch on a little bit today. Questions? So last time we had a little bit left over of mechanics. We played around with gyroscopes and the spin table. They were with the bicycle wheel, we had lots of ability to show conservation of angular momentum. So we could see angular recoil, for example, when I would step on the spin table with an unspinning bicycle wheel, and when I spun it to the left, I would spin to the right myself. Because the total started with zero, it had to end up with zero. If I stepped on the spin table with the bicycle wheel spinning in a upright direction, nothing happened immediately. If I turn that wheel upside down, so it's now spinning in the opposite direction, I would have to be spinning in the direction that the wheel was spinning initially. Because if initially there was angular momentum going around this way, there still has to be angular momentum going around that way, even though the bicycle wheel is now spinning the opposite way because I held it upside down. And remember the surprising result of an unbalanced gyroscope, right? You get this precession. And that explained the fact that the Earth's polar axis, while in our lifetimes is going to be pretty much pointed at Polaris, over the centuries gradually drifts. And it's due to the unbalanced force of the moon on the Earth. And we talked about the tides. Two high tides are separated by about 25 hours, so they're generally speaking two high tides per day, gradually getting to longer and longer hours. And the explanation for that is tricky, right? It's easy to see why the water would be attracted to the moon because it's closer to the moon and so feels a bigger force since the force depends on 1 over the distance squared. But it's kind of hard to see why there should be an accumulation of water on the far side of the Earth. And I tried to convince you that the result was that the Earth is accelerating away from that water. And so if everything is falling towards the moon, it maybe doesn't sound like a good explanation because why don't we hit the moon? But that's the usual story, that if you're going fast enough sideways, you can hit what you're falling towards because the distance you fall every second is made up for by the circular path. So the Earth is falling towards the moon. There's a teeter-totter point, the center of mass, and the moon is falling towards the Earth, but no one's hitting. There's a slight detail which is important, and that is that if the Earth weren't spinning, this bulge really should point at the moon. But the spin of the Earth is kind of carrying the water forward, so the high tide actually leads the moon by a little bit. And the amount of that lead usually depends on the precise location of the shoreline that we're talking about. But because this mass is a little bit ahead of the moon, it's kind of like there was a mountain that was sitting in front of the moon, and it's going to be pulling the moon forward in its orbit. And the result is, just like if you fired your rocket engines, your orbit is going to go to larger and larger radiuses over time. So very, very gradually, again, no effect in our lifetime, centimeters per year, the moon is moving away from the Earth. So when the moon formed long ago, it was a lot closer to the Earth than it is currently. Say again?
How much is the moon?
A few centimeters per year. So it's kind of an incredibly small amount. But surprisingly, we can measure that distance pretty accurately. We've got reflectors, we can shine lasers in and accurately time it takes for the light to go there and back. And the effect was predicted before we had those reflectors. More questions on mechanics. So the plan for the next several days is to be talking about waves, and as much as for any other reason, we're going to start with talking about sound waves. At the very end of this course, we will be interested in the sound of the universe, but right now the main reason for talking about sound waves is just it's the more commonplace example of a wave. So waves in general are able to transport, of course not create or destroy, energy and momentum. And really the first question you should ask about a wave is, what is it that's waving? So evidently when we have a wave, we have a picture that kind of looks like that, where something's going up and down. And the question is, what is it that's going up and down? For a water wave, it's obvious, right? It's the depth of the water that's changing. But what is it for all other sorts of waves? So we also have some wave vocabulary. The distance between two troughs and two peaks, that's called the wavelength. We use the Greek letter lambda for that. The number of cycles per second that would go by a fixed location, that's called the frequency. And of course, if we were to follow this peak, it would be moving at some speed that's called the wave speed. And if you see how many waves are going by per second and you multiply it by the size of a wave, we're going to get the velocity of that wave. So automatically, there's a relationship between the product of the frequency and the wavelength to give you the wave speed. Amplitude is a little bit different from how people traditionally define water waves. What we mean by amplitude is the distance above the equilibrium point. Kind of general questions on waves. So then we moved on to sound. So the first question about a wave should be, what's waving? And what we said, what's waving is air pressure. So currently there are 14.7, 15 pounds per square inch of pressure in this room. What sound consists of is situations where the pressure is a little bit more or a little bit less than that sort of usual value. So if you can imagine if we drew lines in the air, what sound consists of is cases where the air has been pushed together, so it's higher pressure, and correspondingly places where the air has been separated out. So we have compressions and rarefactions. And so if we were to plot the pressure along this line, here we'd have high pressure, here we'd have low pressure, here we'd have high pressure. And this whole sequence of compressions and refractions would be moving at some speed. And of course, those high pressures and low pressures are exactly what moves your eardrum back and forth, which starts the process of sending electrical signals to your brain that we perceive as sound. Questions? So we stress pressure is the thing that changes, but of course if we've moved the air together, we have the same amount of air in smaller volume, so the density of air is also greater here. And if you've compressed something, you've heated it, so also the temperature is going to be higher there. So not only does the air pressure, if you plotted it, look like this, the density would look like that, and the temperature would look like that. All of those things are changing in a sound wave. And the amount is really pretty small compared to the 15 pounds per square inch. Audible noise would be like a millionth of a pound per square inch of extra or deficit. Questions? So then we had some sources of sound that we had the ability to modify the wavelength and the frequency. We had what's called an oscilloscope that allowed us to see the waves. And as I turned a knob, it sounded like a higher and higher pitch, and the waves were getting closer and closer together. So evidently the human perception that we call pitch, that corresponds to frequency. The higher the frequency, the shorter the wavelength, the higher the pitch, the further to the right on the piano. And if we made the waves bigger, it sounded louder. So the thing that corresponds to amplitude is the loudness of the sound. And we could crank that thing around, and my ears quit before your ears, but traditionally people say that you can hear, particularly young ears, can hear up to 20,000 cycles per second as an annoying high pitch. And going the other way, very low frequencies down to about 20 cycles per second. Now, as a matter of fact, you have to have a pretty good speaker to do the full range. So probably a lot of the effect that we were hearing was just because we had a cheap speaker that wasn't able to reproduce 20 hertz, even though it was driven by 20 hertz. We also saw that the size of the instrument seemed to correlate with the wavelength, so that a big instrument like this produced a lower pitch than a smaller instrument like this. Or equivalently, this is a relatively small piece of metal, produces a high pitch. This is a bigger piece of metal, it produces a lower pitch. Questions? Okay, so let's continue on a little bit with sound. Let's talk about the source of sound. How can we make sound? So very commonly, sound is made by having a mechanical oscillation. So when I hit this tuning fork, which you probably won't be able to hear, I can hear it. Maybe you can hear it in the recording. What's happening is these tines are moving back and forth. So they're pushing the air together to make a compression, and then they're pulling away from the air to make a rarefaction. So it's a mechanical sort of process. Same thing that's going on here. That's interesting. So a harder knocker works better. What's happening there is that we're getting a mechanical vibrations that is pushing the air apart and together. But that's not fundamentally what's going on with instruments like these guys or instruments like this guy, right? So there's nothing particularly special about this. But what's happening here is it's actually the air in this bottle that's being the mechanical vibration that's compressing it. So the air in here is vibrating, caused by me blowing on it, and that's what's making the pushing and pulling that's causing the compressions and rarefactions that are perceived as sound for you. Okay, so to make compressions, you have to push the air together somehow or together, and it can be metal that's doing the pushing, it can be the air itself that's doing the pushing. Any of those things work fine. So the other couple of things I want to talk about have to do with back in the days when you had stereos as opposed to iPods. Not uncommonly, you would see something on there which had kind of bouncing bars. So there would be various size bars. I'm not sure if there isn't a mode on my Nano that does the same thing. And these bars gave you the amount of sound at various frequencies. So this might be low frequencies, which usually we call bass. And over here, there might be a bouncing bar that indicated high frequencies, usually treble, and everything in between. You guys seen these things?
Yeah.
So if, you know, if the bass is playing, then we're going to have a lot of low frequency stuff. And if the flute is playing, we're going to have a lot of high frequency stuff. So this is just a graphical way of displaying the amount of sound versus wavelength or frequency. You can take your pick. Yeah, let's use frequency. So in this case, the small frequencies, this is going to be the bass, and the high frequencies, this is going to be the treble, and there could be any old combination of possible sounds. Right, so for example, if the orchestra is playing, they might be playing a C, so there'd be lots of sound at that particular frequency of C, and then maybe they'd be playing a little bit of E and G, and maybe an octave higher, they would be playing some more C. Right, lots of different instruments would be hitting various notes at the same time. Okay, so we call this sort of graph of the amount of sound or any old wave spread out according to frequency or wavelength, we call this a spectra. And it's a great way to analyze the sound that you're hearing. So you could imagine, for example, if you had a really precise spectra, you could figure out exactly what instruments are playing. Right? You could kind of undo the music to convert it from the sound to the actual notes. Okay, so I mentioned orchestras. There's another type of sound that we're familiar with, noise. What's the difference between noise and what goes on with an orchestra? Organized, so tell me more. Yeah, I like random. I like unorganized.
No.
So actually, exactly a nice wave like this is produced by something like that.
Okay. Yeah. So an orchestra, you've got it's a good orchestra, organized frequencies that are pretty nicely related to each other. Whereas when you hear like a wave crash against the shore or something, you're hearing a lot of complex combinations of frequencies and harmonics.
I like a lot of that. So we said that this would be the orchestra where, you know, people are playing particular notes. If we have a random process like noise, then there's no one leading the charge, right? There's no one at the baton. Everyone's doing whatever they want. So with a random process, we expect a random set of frequencies to be present. Right? They're not going to hit C and E and miss all of the possible notes in between, particularly all of the out-of-tune notes in between. But for random noise, and probably a good example of this is crowd noise, we expect that there's going to be sound at every imaginable frequency, right? Because no one's tuned the instruments. So this is a big difference in the type of spectra. So here we have just a few notes present by design, and kind of confusingly, we call this an emission spectra. Perhaps even more confusingly, it's called a bright line spectra. Whereas this case here, where we have more or less the same amount of sound at every frequency and every frequency between every frequency, this is called a continuous spectra. And we kind of expect continuous spectra anytime we have a random process that's doing the stuff. If we have something that's created intentionally, then maybe we're just going to have a few frequencies, as in an orchestra, even an out-of-tune orchestra, you know, there are only so many musical instruments, so there are only going to be so many frequencies present. But waves crashing, crowd noise, where 10,000 people are crying with different noises, with different voices, we're going to get a more or less continuous set of the amount of sound at every conceivable wavelength. Okay, so spectra, a great way to analyze sound. And finally for sound, I want to talk about the Doppler effect. And I guess I should capitalize Doppler because it's somebody's name. Well, maybe the place to start is going to be with these online videos, because they can draw things a lot better than I can draw them. Well, while we wait for the camera to mount up, let's listen to the Doppler effect. Well, maybe we'll wait for the camera to warm up, because this thing actually has video and sound on it. Okay, so I'm sure we've all had this experience. Works great with sirens, too. So the effect we're listening to is, as the car approached, the pitch was higher, and when the car went past us, the pitch was lower. And of course, it's the same horn. It's only making one pitch. So that's what the Doppler effect is about. It's about the change in the apparent pitch because of the motion of the source or the observer. It doesn't really matter. So we've got, you know, another one of these beautiful real-life demonstrations here. So what we have here is a helicopter and a person, and I can have the helicopter make sounds. And we can see the frequency of the sound and the wavelength of the sound, and I can change the speed. Let's move this guy away, first of all. Well, let's actually have him approach, because that's how the car is. So if you look to see what happens, because the source of sound is moving forward, the wavelength here is shorter, which would mean the pitch is higher. So when the helicopter approaches the guy, the pitch is high. If the helicopter moves away from the guy, the pitch is going to be a lot longer. So when the car is approaching, we have a high pitch. If the car is receding from us, we have a low pitch. While we've got the lights out, let me kind of remind you of this, again, nicer picture than I can draw of how the tides are working. And I remind you, we talked about the joint effect of the sun and the moon, so that we have weak tides a moment ago when things were at 90 degrees, and we have extra big tides now when the sun and the moon are acting together. So we have neap tides coming up, those are the weak tides, and we have extra strong tides, which are called spring tides, when the sun and the moon are acting together, which includes when they're 180 degrees apart. Okay, any questions on these kind of cheesy animations? Which, if you want, you can play with yourself. They're all online. You can move the helicopter in all sorts of different ways. Okay, so we all know that if it's on the web, it must be true. So let's see if we can do the Doppler effect kind of in the room. And let me comment that this is a terrible demonstration from my point of view, because what I'm going to be doing is twirling this thing around. So this thing isn't approaching or receding from me, so I hear absolutely no effect. But it should be moving towards and away from you, so I hope you hear an effect. And even if you don't hear an effect, pretend that you do. Do you hear a wobbling noise? At least you're lying pretty effectively. Okay, so it even sometimes works in demo mode. Okay, so I have kind of one last bit of sound to bring up. And I actually already have the words written down here. So we have the sounds that you can normally hear, this 20 to 20,000 hertz, sounds that are above the normal range of human hearing. Those are called ultrasonics. And the name for sounds that are too low to hear, elephants can hear these sounds, for example, those are called infrasonics. And mostly I stress these names because pretty much the same names are going to apply to light, and that's really where most of our emphasis is going to be. Any questions about sound? Well, so if you know all the answers, then what was the answer to the question I posed at the last exam, at the end of the last class?
You were asking about why the violin or a flute playing the same note sounded.
Yeah, so you can easily distinguish a violin playing an A from a flute playing exactly the same A. What's different? That's the name of what's different. But what is actually different?
It's the range of harmonics that are present.
I like it. So typically, devices produce not just one frequency, they also produce automatically harmonics. And if I kind of overblow this organ pipe, you can hear, I think, a couple of different frequencies. So that's blowing lightly. It's not working for me today. Just getting louder of the same. How about this one? I don't hear the effect. Nah. It's not working today. So usually you have not just one frequency present, you have several different frequencies present. So when you play an A, not only you're playing an A, you're usually playing the next day up an octave higher, and so it goes. And every musical instrument will have a different fingerprint pattern of harmonics that it's generating. So a violin might produce an extra large amount of an octave higher than the A it's playing compared to a flute. And it turns out that particularly pure tones are things like that. That is a pretty good sine wave. Now, famous dead French physicists actually showed that there's a relationship between what we've just been describing and something that sounds a whole lot different. So this is a guy named Fourier. And so what we've said is the difference between a violin and a flute playing the same notion are the harmonics. And the other thing that's different is the wave shape. So I've been drawing nice waves like this. But if you remembered when I played the oscilloscope with this organ pipe, the wave actually didn't have that nice shape. It had a shape that was kind of like that. It was repetitive. It had a definite frequency and wavelength, but it wasn't a pure sine wave. So it turns out that Fourier showed mathematically that these are identical formulations, that any imaginable wave shape can be also thought of as particular harmonic content. So you can kind of go between those two and pick your favorite explanation. So-called pure tones like this are nice sine waves. Things that have, you know, kind of funny sounds like that have lots of harmonic content. Tuning forks, which is why they're used, also have very limited harmonic content, very nice sine waves. Questions? Okay, so much for sound. As I say, we will come back to sound when we talk about the sound of the universe. Oh, I guess there's one other thing I want to talk about a little bit more. And that's air pressure. And what we said last time was air pressure is a result of all of these molecules hitting you supersonically and bouncing off your body, kind of pushing you back, just like bullets would push you back if a machine gun hit you. Less deadly, though. But what's kind of fundamentally involved in air pressure? And I want to ask what I think is a very funny question. Why doesn't the atmosphere fall down? And so I hope I've convinced you that the atmosphere is made out of little point particles that are flying around just like this rock, but, you know, the rock falls down. Pretty much there isn't. So pretty much the composition of the Earth's atmosphere until you get really, really high is the same. You know, roughly speaking, 20% oxygen and 80% nitrogen. So the composition doesn't change a whole lot with altitude. No, because if I throw that rock supersonically, it does the same thing. So let's ask what is really the same question. Why doesn't the ocean fall to the bottom? And so in both cases, we have stuff. Why doesn't it go all the way down? And there's only one possible answer to this, if you think about it. And Newton gave us the answer. If something isn't falling, then it can't have a net force on it, right? That rock is falling because there's a net force down on it. So the only possibility for why this piece of air doesn't fall to the ground is because there's no net force on it. And we know there's a force of gravity on it. Air weighs stuff. If you've ever had a full scuba tank as opposed to an empty scuba tank, you can tell the difference. So obviously there's a gravitational force on this air. There must be some other force that's pushing it up. Right? No alternative, right? So here's a hunk of air. Gravity is pulling it down. Something must be pushing it up so that we can have an equilibrium. So how does the Earth push back up? Yeah. I don't think I'm happy with the Earth pushing. Say again? Nope. So a lot of planets spin a lot slower than the Earth does, and they haven't lost their atmosphere. It hasn't sunk to the layer on the ground like marbles. Well, if you think about it, air pressure, what's that story? So this thing is being pushed up 15 pounds for every square inch. There are a lot of square inches here. I'm being pushed pretty hard that away. Harder than any linebacker could push me. But I'm not going that way. Well, of course, I've got a rear end too, right? A rather large one, and it's pushing me in the exact opposite direction. But think about the situation here. Maybe the pressure here is a little bit less. I'm just making up numbers now. Maybe it's 14.5 pounds per square inch. So here we're pushing it down, here we're Here we're pushing it up, here we're pushing it down, and there can be a net force on the object. And I think you know that if you go up in the Earth's atmosphere, the pressure gets less. If you go up from the bottom of the ocean, the pressure gets less. So the pressure change with altitude, that pressure difference is what's making this upward force, sometimes it's called the buoyant force, which is countering the force of gravity. I mostly believe everything you said. So the part that I didn't believe had to do with the ocean. It turns out that the ocean water is pretty incompressible. So even though it's under high pressure, it pretty much has the same density as the top of the ocean does. It is slightly more, but not hugely more. But air is not like water. It expands real easily. So when you reduce the pressure on air, it will expand and it'll have lower density. So not only is the pressure less on the top, the density is less. But even if the density weren't less, we'd have less pressure. So this is actually part of the Eureka statement, right? Archimedes ran from his bathtub when he figured out this fact about the buoyant force, that it's the pressure difference that is literally holding up the fluid. And if you think about how that has to work, let's talk about the ocean since maybe it's a little bit easier. Let's try and figure out what the pressure is at some depth underneath the ocean. So if we're at some depth, H, we know that there's some fluid here that has a mass. And the force of gravity is the mass times G. That's a force that's down. The force that's up is the pressure, and it's in pounds per square inch. So I need to multiply it by the number of square inches here at the bottom. And these two things have to be the same, right? The force down of gravity has to be equal to the force up due to the pressure force. And if we just have a couple of more steps, this word density, you might remember it's the ratio of the mass to the volume, right? We take two extensive quantities and divide them and we get an intrinsic quantity. So I can calculate this mass by taking the density. And let me comment that we have a fondness for Greek letters, and usually the Greek letter that is used for density is rho. So I need to multiply that by the volume, and the volume of this parallelogram is the area on the bottom times the height. So if I put together the pieces I've got the density times area times height times the acceleration of gravity has to equal the pressure. It's hard to see the difference, I guess, between my rows and my p's. Spell rho, R-H-O, and you can see that the area cancels out. So the pressure builds up according to the depth that you go down into the ocean. And it turns out that about 10 meters of water are the same as one atmosphere of pressure, normal pressure. So we live in an ocean of air, right? You go high enough, there's the top of the atmosphere. As we go down, the pressure gets more and more and more and more. And it's pretty much the same story in our atmosphere as it is in the ocean. Questions? Okay, so let's talk light. So The first question that you should ask about a wave is, what is it that's waving? And so supposedly, if I were to draw a line from this light bulb to your eye, there's something that's going like that. Something that's big and then small and then big. What is it? What is it that is big? And so for water waves, it's the depth of the ocean. For sound waves, it's the pressure. What is it that is fundamentally light? Is it what? Nah, because that's just another word for light, basically.
Are you asking what the what matter?
Yeah, so here's my light bulb. Right, and here's my eye. And we know that there's something along that line. Well, but these are, I think, just names. Photon is a $10 word. I'll write it down and we will care about it. But what is it, right? So there has to be something that is lots and then little and then lots again. And we can look at the distance between that and that'll be a wavelength and all of that sort of stuff. So what is there lots of and then little of? Right, so for sound, it's pressure. It's not temperature. It turns out that, well, temperature is a little bit of a tricky quantity, but essentially in the absence of material, you can't have temperature, but light goes just fine through a vacuum. And having made that statement, that should bother you a little bit. So when I use the word vacuum, what I mean is an absence of atoms. Obviously, there can be light in a vacuum. So a vacuum isn't literally nothing. It means an absence of atoms. And light can travel in an absence of atoms. Well, if there's nothing there, then it's hard to say what there's lots of when the So whatever this lots is, it can't involve stuff. Because it can exist in a vacuum. So name some things that aren't made out of stuff. Say again? Well, yeah, but that's, I don't think that gets us very far, right? Some waves are made out of stuff like sound waves, and we're trying to figure out what the light waves are made out of that isn't stuff. Right? Hope, love, charity aren't made out of stuff, but light isn't made out of that, unfortunately. Yeah. So everything is stuff. Stuff. I guess that's not too big a surprise, because our experience with things that isn't stuff is kind of limited, but it's actually present in this room. Well, of course, because there's light, but more obvious evidences of it. And so it's a magnet, right? And magnetism isn't stuff. Magnetism moves stuff, but it isn't itself stuff. Does that make sense? Another example of something that isn't stuff maybe would help, and that's gravity, right? Gravity is caused by stuff. But out in the midst of space where there's nothing, there's still gravity. So gravity isn't itself stuff.
So we're just talking about energy then?
Well, the complicated word for it is force fields. I don't like energy because energy could be lots of things. So things like gravity, electricity, magnetism. Actually, can't go very far down this list, but we will go down that list totally at some point. So none of those things are stuff. They all have a source that is stuff, but they exist independent of that stuff. Right? So in space, there is gravity, there is electricity, there's magnetism. In the absence of stuff, it still works, right? So magnets would work just as well in a vacuum chamber as they do in air. Okay, so I think it's pretty clear that gravity isn't the source of light. There are waves of gravity, and we can argue whether they've been detected or not. They're very weak, they're hard to detect. I guess I would say they've been detected, and we'll probably talk about that at some point. But very difficult and not as commonplace as light is. So what we're left with is electricity and magnetism. And that's what's here. There's lots of electricity and magnetism there, and there is actually little electricity and magnetism in between. So I was actually forced to memorize the phraseology in high school that light is pulsating, propagating electrostatic and magnetic fields of force acting upon each other at right angles. So, I don't know, you should too, I guess. So what's in that little ditty? So we can think about electricity as, you know, having plus and minus and pushing things to one direction. And, you know, in the realm of great demonstrations, I have one. So here you can think about a sheet of electricity that's pointing that way. And on top of that, put a sheet of electricity that's pointing in the same way, but not as strong. And put on top of that a sheet where there is no electricity. And put on top of that a sheet where the electricity is reversed and not quite so strong. And put on top of that a sheet where the electricity is just as strong as it was originally and reversed. Okay, so that's a start to thinking about what an electromagnetic wave is. So something like this is flying from this light towards your eyeball, and it has a wavelength and a frequency. But it's not just electricity. So it turns out that perpendicular to this stack, there is also magnetic stuff. So where there is a big electric field, there's also a big magnetic field, but it's pushing stuff, pushing iron, as it were, in a different direction than the electricity is pushing it. Okay, so light is electromagnetic stuff. That I do want you to memorize. I'm looking for chalk. I managed to hide it. Ah, here it is. So, wavelength, frequency, amplitude. What are those sorts of things for light? But before we go exactly in that direction, let's realize that human perception is not all that is. Right? So for sound, there were sounds above what we can see, and there are sounds below what we can hear. And the same thing applies to light. So let's not take a human-centric point of view. Let's realize that light is more than what we can see with our eyes. So there will be frequencies that are above what we can see with our eyes, and there will be frequencies that are below what we can see with our eyes. But it's all light. And if we expand our definitions of light that way, then we're soon going to realize that there is lots more to light than what we can literally see. So here we have kind of a display of the various wavelengths of light. So it starts down here with radio waves. And if you think about it, that makes pretty good sense. What is radio waves? Well, radio waves are produced by having an antenna that has electrical stuff that's going back and forth. So what's coming out of that radio antenna are regions of lots of electromagnetic stuff and reversed electromagnetic stuff and back to the same amount of electromagnetic stuff. So all that radio waves are is longer than usual wavelengths of light. Wavelengths of light that are kind of typically measured in meters sort of size. So if you listen to AM radio, anyone listen to AM radio? And if so, what's the frequency of that?
1410.
Say again?
1410.
1410. So that's 1.4 million cycles per second. How about FM radio? Yeah, here typically the numbers are hundreds, and those turn out to be hundreds of millions of cycles per second. Right, so I don't know, so something might be at 101 megahertz, whereas it would be 1410 kilohertz. And so basically a factor of 100 difference between the wavelengths that are involved in AM radio and the wavelengths that are involved in FM radio. So I'm not sure it's exactly obvious, but usually it's easier to make big things than small things, and AM radio came first, basically because it was easier to produce the longer waves than it was easier to produce the shorter waves. Now, absent from this diagram is microwaves. So inside your microwave, we have pulsating, propagating, electrostatic, and magnetic fields of force acting upon each other at right angles. We have light. Not visible light, but it's nonetheless light. It has a frequency that's measured in gigahertz, billions of cycles per second. I'm sure you've seen heat lamps. Often they glow with a dull red, but it's not the red that's important. It's actually the wavelengths that you can't see that are doing most of the heating for heat lamps. So this is infrared light. So it's the same infra that's involved in the word infra for infrasonics. And then in this real narrow range, we have all the colors of the rainbow. So human perception is just this kind of factor of two of possible wavelengths. So first of all, notice kind of a huge difference between hearing and seeing. Right, so for hearing, you can see a range from 20 to 20,000. You can see a factor of 1,000. You can hear a factor of 1,000 of different frequencies. Whereas for seeing, you only see a factor of 2 of different frequencies or wavelengths. So our hearing is really, in a lot of senses, much more sensitive than our seeing. Okay, so up there, we've got even shorter wavelengths of light than your eye can perceive. Ultraviolet light, again, ultra, same sense that we had for sound. And I hope those names terrify you. They should terrify you. And those are all killers. Ultraviolet light is, maybe you think of it as being nice suntan, but it's just future skin cancer. X-rays, right? Cancer, gamma rays, cancer. These are all not your friends. So somehow or other, those shorter wavelengths pack a punch that is not healthy. Yeah, you're jumping a lecture or two ahead, but it turns out that just as there are fundamental chemical units, there's a smallest amount of sodium you can have, which is an atom. It turns out that light comes in little pulses too. And of course, the more pulses, the higher the higher total amount of energy. But the energy can come as lots of little feather ticks, who cares, or as a bunch of punches. So it turns out that each one, that the smallest available amount of gamma rays, each one of which packs a really bigger punch than the smallest amount of radio waves. So these guys are bad because each individual, it's not what it is called exactly as photon, each individual photon of light is carrying a bigger punch than an individual photon of infrared light. And so they can, in particular, kill cells and cause chemical reactions. Whereas, you know, a lot of feather touches from infrared light can't do the same thing. So you can take the same amount of energy in infrared light and have no effect. Take that same energy in gamma rays and you will be dead. Okay, so here we have the colors of the rainbow displayed for us. So red has the longest wavelength. Blue has the shortest wavelength. So this is the high frequency light. This is the low frequency light. And we see all the colors of the rainbow between them. Are there colors that aren't colors of the rainbow? Name them, right? It's an example.
Brown.
I missed what you said.
Gray.
Yeah, okay. I guess I can live with gray. I'm not sure gray is a color. White isn't. Is white a color? I wouldn't say so.
White's not a color.
No,
it's not. Black is combination.
No, in painting it is.
Yes, and it. Yes.
And light, white is all.
Yes. Yep. I totally agree with I think both of you, which may sound impossible. Okay, so let's go with where you're going. So what white light is, just say it again.
All the colors mushed together,
right? So if you take the rainbow, let me phrase it in reverse. What a rainbow is white light broken apart. So in the sun's light, before it went through the rainbow, it was all of those colors simultaneously and it looked white. So all the rainbow did is to separate the pieces that are already present in sunlight. And if you take all of those colors and put them back together, it'll look white. Incidentally, Newton was the guy who first did these experiments of breaking apart the sun's light and putting it back together and being convinced that white light was just lots of colors together. And I would say that gray is just less white and black is no white, right? Black means no light is coming. So you may have heard about black light bulbs, but that's something different than black. So what a black light bulb is it's ultraviolet light. It's light that you can't see that is present. But if I look at your black shirt, what I'm really seeing is nothing, an absence of light from it. And so if I turn off all the lights in this room, it's black. Even though your shirt is still orange, it looks black because nothing's coming off of it. Yeah, yep. All of the colors together, so we're going to have simultaneously something like noise. So let's go back to my original question. We got brown there as a color that isn't in the rainbow. What other colors aren't in the rainbow but have nicely defined names?
Maroon.
I believe maroon. How about a more common name Okay, so guys are often bad with colors. You say maroon, I say purple. I agree that maroon is slightly different from purple. But if we had a vote, because there are more men in this room, I think we'd say that they're the same.
Sure.
Pink, I go with pink. So a lot of people think that purple and violet are the same color. The women all say no, and I agree with them. Right? Purple and violet are certainly not the same thing. Maroon may be a version of purple. Yeah, so we've come up now with lots of colors that aren't in the rainbow. So what are they? Yeah, they're just particular combinations of rainbow colors. Right, so purple is a combination of red and blue. So fundamentally, there are only these colors, but we perceive particular combinations of them as being different. And we have names for them. So we can mix colors or we can mix paints. And all we really need are these set of colors and so-called primary colors, and we can get everything we want. Notice that it's not the same with sound, right? So if I mix something in the bass and something in the treble, I don't hear a new sound. I hear bass and treble together. So our ear is really able to distinguish a whole lot better than our eye is able to distinguish. Yep, so I agree with everything you're saying, but when we're talking about timbre, we're talking about simultaneously having different frequencies present already. But if I can hear that note, and I can hear that note, if I hear them all together, I don't hear a new note, I hear them all together. So I don't call that a third note, but we do with that with purple, right? If we have simultaneously present blue and red, it looks like purple. We give it a new name. It doesn't look like blue, it doesn't look like red, it looks like something new. Okay, so I got kind of another cheesy demonstration to remind you about this nature of light. Yeah. So here we have a picture, and you can see that the sun is producing photons of light of every imaginable color. And we perceive that as white. And the spectrum that we've got is pretty much the same amount of all of the colors of light. And the particular purpose of this is to see how absorption works. If I put something in the way of this stream of particles, various colors may be scattered. So you see some of these photons going in a new direction. Some of them may be absorbed, but in any case, I have different stuff coming than what I had before. So I wish I could say yes, because it would make a nice story. But I think that something else is going on. So I think that the star, like these pair of lasers, was producing two different colors simultaneously. Now I have these pointed in different directions. So you see a red and a green laser. But the Earth's atmosphere is acting like a prism. And so the various colors are being bent various amounts. So you might notice that currently we have red and green in a direct horizontal line. But when I insert this prism, the green has been bent more than the red. And what we had is the atmosphere is an unsteady object, and so sometimes we were seeing that green light and sometimes we were seeing that red light. There is an absorption effect from stars too when they're close to the Earth's atmosphere, but that just makes, turns out that that just makes them look red. Because the Earth's atmosphere fundamentally absorbs the blue. So this thing is only absorbing these colors, but mostly what our atmosphere does is it preferentially gets rid of the blue. So anything that's close to the very close to the horizon has a tendency to look red. More questions? So let me just, got this picture that reproduces what we just saw. So what we have is we have a prism. We can take what was white light and we can break it up into its component parts. The red light is bent the least, the blue light is bent the most, and in between things are bent various amounts of angle. And if we're going to make a spectrum, that's of course what we have to do. We have to break light into its component parts, and we have to put a light meter here and figure out the amount of this color of light and move that light meter down this spectrum in order to get an idea of how much light there is at every conceivable wavelength. Okay, so we see that one way of doing this is by using a prism. And I hope you saw it's not a real effective way, right? Yeah, the blue light, the green light was bent a little bit more than the red light, but not hugely so. So is there a way of breaking up the white light into other sorts of colors more efficiently? And you know, you've all looked at your CDs and you see rainbows in your CD. You've done that, haven't you? So why, what is it that makes this CD act like a prism, have the ability to take white light and break it up into its component parts? Well, you know what this CD is, it's just line after line after line after line. So evidently, just the presence of lots of very closely spaced lines, somehow or other is able to break up light into its component parts. So it's called a diffraction grating, and I've got a piece of it here. And it's weirdly more effective than the prism was. Let's see if I can make it work. Oops, I want to hold it this way, I guess. So first of all, mostly what happens is nothing, right? You can see that those big things are very blobby the way they were before. But if you look carefully, way over to the right and actually on the door frame, you can see on either side a green dot. Do people see the green dot? Way over kind of by the telescope. Halfway to the telescope. So some of this light is highly deflected. And if the lights were dimmer, you could see that the red light is also deflected. Except in this case, the red light is deflected more than the green light. Let me, it might work a little bit better closer so things are brighter. I can see, maybe you can't see. The red light is maybe 6 inches to the beyond where the green pattern is. Okay, so most of the light is going straight. The red light now is being deflected more than the green light. This thing is just like your CD. It has lots of parallel lines embedded in this piece of plastic, and somehow it's able to do the same thing that a prism is able to do, a lot cheaper. Okay, so we'll call it quits there.